Yeah, so you have the crucifixion, the fact that after the crucifixion, I mean, I don't even need a verse in the Bible to say that the disciples were in a state of despair. That's just a psychological reality. If anybody could imagine their best friend and the person upon whom they hung the universe was torn away from them quickly, violently, unexpectedly, involving torture, and the person was gone, how would you feel when your life and 3 years of devotion had been stolen from you? Yeah, they're going to be in a pretty bad frame of mind, and that's not questioned. Well, out of that despair comes the belief. Now here, I talk about the empty tomb, and from what I can tell, about two-thirds of scholars writing today, scholars, I'm very particular about that term because unfortunately in our world today, both the UK and the US and many other places, there are a lot of people who become instant scholars, quote-unquote, when they start talking about religion, and they don't have any credentials, and they just kind of go off. So I'm talking about people who have credentials and have reasons behind them for their conclusions. I'd say about two-thirds of them believe the empty tomb. So my point is, I don't have as much unanimity on that one as I have on the others. Mm-hmm. But so sometimes I use the empty tomb and sometimes I don't. But the most important single fact to which virtually every scholar will agree is that the disciples had real experiences which they believed were something they saw with their physical eyes, and they believe they saw the risen Jesus. I say physical eyes. More and more, the bodily resurrection of Jesus is coming back into vogue. That's partly because of Tom Wright's book on the resurrection of the Son of God. 500 pages of that book are dedicated not to proving the resurrection per se, but to ask the question, what kind of resurrection, or what does the word resurrection mean? And it's bodily. But other people were already on board. John Dominic Cross and Gert Ludemann, both very skeptical, who say, well, you know, I don't believe that, but the New Testament definitely believed Jesus appeared bodily. So I don't hang it on bodily resurrection, but I do want to make a point of these appearances that the disciples thought, they at least thought Jesus appeared to them. And critics will grant you that. They'll grant that James and Paul were two skeptics who came to Christianity because they thought they saw the risen Jesus. They'll grant you those things. So those are some of the things, and then I want to say, all right, how can you go after this set of facts historically and decide what happened?
So these, if you like, if you're boiling down a whole lot, as you say, there are many, many subsets of issues to do with the resurrection, but these would be some of the absolute key central ones that you would pull out in a sort of debate where you were being asked to prove that the resurrection did happen. Well, in the next section, we're going to learn a little from you, Gary, on how these aspects for you prove beyond reasonable doubt that Jesus was resurrected, and we'll be continuing our discussion. You're listening to Unbelievable. This is Justin Brierley with you through till 4 o'clock this afternoon, and the first in our series of looking at American Masters of Apologetics, Gary Habermas, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and Philosophy at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, is with me on the program today. He is a worldwide renowned expert on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and we're going to be continuing our discussion with him in a short moment. Welcome back to the program. I'm Justin Brierley. You're listening to Unbelievable here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. And if you're able to tune in next week between 2:30 and 4, we're going to be continuing this series of American Masters of Apologetics. Next week, it's my pleasure to have on the program William Lane Craig, better known as Bill to many. Bill Lane Craig, research professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology. He is one of the foremost apologists for the Christian gospel in the world. We're going to be looking particularly at his third edition of his book, Reasonable Faith, which is a core book for anyone interested in defense of the Christian faith. We're going to be having an in-depth interview one-on-one with William Lane Craig. So anyone who wants to know about the skills of apologetics, that's worth tuning in for at the same time, 2:30 till 4 o'clock.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And welcome back to our discussion with Gary Habermas as we talk about the resurrection. Now, Gary has written many books on the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, if you go to the Premier shop, and type in the name Gary Habermas, it'll come up with a variety of books that you might want to purchase if you want to look at more depth at some of the arguments we've been talking about for the resurrection. Gary, you've toured the US, you've toured the world talking about the resurrection, and you've pioneered what you've been describing to us, the minimal facts approach to argument for the resurrection. So you explained before we went to our break some of those minimal facts. They include the crucifixion and death of Jesus Christ, the complete sense of despair that overwhelmed his followers. You say that often you will use the empty tomb, but very key, obviously, is that the disciples were convinced that they saw the resurrected Jesus. So if you like, if those are pillars, those are the four minimal facts you were looking at, why for you would they prove demonstrably that Jesus had risen from the dead?
Great question, Justin. With those four, when I use the real small minimal group, I rarely use the empty tomb because it doesn't meet my own criteria of you know, the 90 percentile type. But I'll also throw in Paul and James.
Absolutely.
And two others. I'll often throw in that the resurrection is a central belief for the early church, because the more central something is, the more it has to be explained. And lastly, the early proclamation of resurrection, and nobody questions this. For example, let's take some British scholars recently, like James D.G. Dunn up at Durham, certainly Richard Bauckham, who was at St. Andrews in Scotland, but he's retired now and he lives in Cambridge, and up at Edinburgh, Larry Hurtado, and these three folks argue that the proclamation of the resurrection can actually be dated to whatever date the crucifixion is given, usually 30 or 33. The point is, whatever date it was, the resurrection proclamation starts from that date. And the way they get there is by using the text in 1 Corinthians 15:3 and following, which is, I mean, if there's a conclusion in the New Testament that everybody agrees to, it's that Paul is citing material that is not his. He's the author of the book, but this material is given to him by somebody else, and it's in a creedal form. It's in a kind of a da-da-da-da-da-da-da form, not really like English rhyming, but it's more Hebrew a form of narration that can be easily remembered, because most of Jesus' hearers, we think, were illiterate. And so they would pass these teachings on orally, and people were used to memorizing, and Paul's passing on an early form. Well, to make a long story short, it's that the consensus view among scholars is that Paul probably received this material in Jerusalem from Peter and James, as he outlines in Galatians chapter 1, verses 18 and following. He says he went up to Jerusalem after 3 years, within 3 years of his conversion, and he met Peter and James, and in the context, they're talking about the gospel. So I guess you can make one of two moves. Either that Paul received that creedal material from Peter and James, which is the majority view, and it's interesting that Peter and James are the only other two individuals who are in that list, because Paul appends his name at the end, but Peter and James are the only two who are on the list. Or you could say that if he didn't actually receive this formal creedal material, then he at least got the stories, the resurrection accounts, on which that is based. So critics freely will let you go back to, you know, 3 years after the cross for Paul's reception of this material, which puts it, whatever date the cross is, plus three. And then Paul says, beginning of Galatians 2, and nobody questions the Pauline authorship of Galatians or 1 Corinthians. Paul says a few years later, 14 years later, he went back to Jerusalem, Galatians chapter 2, and here's Peter again, and here's Paul again, and now John is there, and they're specifically talking about the gospel. I tell people that Galatians 2:2 might be one of the most incredible verses in the New Testament. Paul said, I went up to see the pillars in the church, and I set before them the gospel I was preaching to see if I was running in vain. And you think, Paul, you've been preaching for several years now, and you're going up there just to make sure that you're preaching the right thing? And I think Paul would say, well, you're not really listening. I told you, A, I got this from Jesus himself at the resurrection appearance that I had personally. B, I went up to Jerusalem just 3 years later, and I got it from James and Peter. This is at least my third trip up to Jerusalem before the guys to make sure we're still on target. I'm not inventing the message here. I just want to make sure we're all on target. And so he lays before them the gospel, Galatians 2:2, and he says in verse 6, Galatians 2:6, they added nothing to me. They added nothing. In other words, by the time Paul gets done talking with the other three apostles, they're all on the same page, and regarding the gospel, of which the resurrection is the center, as Paul says in that creed, 1 Corinthians 15:3 and 4, he was raised from the dead the third day. They're all on the same page. And so what I think this, to me, Justin, is the single most overlooked argument. Christians, evangelicals are used to saying, well, what do you do with this, and what do you do with this, and what do you do with this, and they give evidences. I think we would be better off spending our time on these two trips to Jerusalem, and whatever you do with Acts 15 is either, scholars either think it's the same as Galatians 2, or Paul took another trip to Jerusalem specifically to spend time with Peter, James, and John, and to lay the gospel out and decide whether it was true or not. And they all were on the page. Now, what's key about this is that this is done at a very, very, very early date, these meetings, starting just 3 years after the cross. Secondly, you got the biggest names you could possibly get, the biggest eyewitnesses. In fact, you couldn't name anybody in the New Testament who's more central to the Christian proclamation than the two of the 12 apostles, namely Peter and John, and then the two who come later, who are called apostles, James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul. And these four all have seen Jesus, all give eyewitness testimony to their appearance. And so somehow you have to explain this early eyewitness combined efforts. When I lecture on this subject, I often put my two hands together and kind of twist my fingers in and out of the other, you know, among each other, because that's what's really happening. In Galatians 1 and 2, you're talking about the right people at the right place at the right time, talking about the right message. It's the center of Christianity. In Galatians 2:6, they added nothing to me. They're all on the same page.
And ultimately, it kind of blows out of the water any criticism that, well, the resurrection of Jesus was a kind of mythology that arose over time, hundreds of years or something like that, and was added in later. I mean, I was just reading a biography. I don't know if you've heard of him, but there's a sort of an illusionist and kind of mind control guy called Derren Brown here in the UK, kind of equivalent to David Blaine in the US. But he, as it happens, was an evangelical Christian as a youth, and in his biography he explains how he became an atheist, and what he says is that he came to realise that, you know, these accounts could easily have been doctored and made to be changed and, you know, whatever the author wanted them to say about them. But you're saying that it simply shows up in the record of what Paul wrote that this was a belief right from the start.
And not just a major belief from the start, but you're right. Major is important. From the start is important. But you're not talking about periphery people here. You're talking about the four biggest names in the early church. And then the point I made before talking about the early is the central. The fact that this is the very center of Christianity. It's not a periphery belief. You know, we all tend to be more sure of those things closest to our heart. I mean, I would care. If I know you just had a child, you and your wife, I would care, Justin, if you started this interview and said, "Hey, listen, I'm kind of got something heavy on my mind today because one of my children's sick." Well, I would care about your sick child, and I suppose you mine, but I would care more if my child were sick, and vice versa. The things closer to our hearts get more attention. And the fact that everything depends on the resurrection, the fact that it's linked to almost every major area of theology in the New Testament, the fact that it's linked to almost every major area of practice, we know that if it didn't happen, our faith is in vain. So non-Christians hit that over and over, we talked about that earlier, Christians keep returning to it too. So when it's the central thing and you spend spend a lot of time on it, and you're using the skeptics' facts, I think this web we're weaving here, right people, right place, right time, right topic, I think we're going after it the way ancient historians do. And I will just add,